What's up, everybody? This is Healing Intentions, and I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. This podcast is about natural health and wellness, mental health, cannabis, psychedelics, philosophy, and spirituality. Today, my guest is Dr. Rick Kirshner. Dr. Rick Kirshner is a retired professional speaker, business skills educator, personal and executive coach, filmmaker, blogger, and an internationally best-selling author. As founder of the Art of Change LLC, he delivered motivational speeches and training programs on the Art of Change Skills for Life nationally and internationally to some of the best known organizations in the world, including the FDA, the Federal Reserve, NASA, Nationwide Insurance, Starbucks, Texas Instruments, and Toyota. He delivered his ideas and advice on communication, persuasion, and conflict resolution through hundreds of radio and television appearances, newspaper and magazine articles, and interviews, from CNBC to CBC to Fox to the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, London Times, Executive Excellence, and Reader's Digest. From 1980 to 1986, he delivered training programs on communication from Los Angeles to Seattle. In 1987, he was one of only 15 speakers chosen by the Tom Peters Group to present the revolutionary In Search of Excellence and Thriving on Chaos training programs to businesses and organizations around the globe. His co-authored audio program, Dealing with Difficult People, was on Columbia House's all-time top 10 bestseller list. In 1994, he and Dr. Rick Brinkman co-authored the McGraw-Hill international best-selling book, Dealing with People You Can't Stand, How to Bring Out the Best in People at Their Worst. It has been translated into 27 languages and was updated and re-released as a second edition in 2002, a third revised edition in 2012. The Macmillan audiobook version was released in 2010, and an enhanced iTunes audiobook version was released in 2011. In 1998, he co-authored the McGraw-Hill book, Life by Design, Making Wise Choices, which is available in three languages. In 2002, McGraw-Hill released the third book by the team of Brinkman and Kirshner, Dealing with Relatives, Bringing Out the Best in Family at Their Worst. Their last book together, Love Thy Customer, was selected as McGraw-Hill's Business Book of the Year 2006. In 2007, Dr. Kirshner authored the comprehensive Insider's Guide to the Art of Persuasion, consisting of two books, the guidebook and the playbook, along with a 32-track audio program on the topic. He is the author or co-author of 11 audio and video programs on customer service, communication, and life management. His last book, How to Click with People, Building the Personal Side of Business, was published in June 2011 by Hyperion Books. In 2015, he wrote and produced a documentary film, How Healthcare Became Sick Care, The True History of Medicine. Dr. Kirshner was an Oregon-licensed naturopathic physician from 1981 until he retired his license in 2019. His daughter runs the company he founded. He served as president of the Naturopathic Medicine Institute in 2020. He lives in the panhandle of northern Idaho with his wife of 31 years, along with his one-eyed cat and four chickens. Let's get started. Hello, welcome everybody to another episode of Healing Intentions. This is your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti, and today I have a very special guest, Dr. Rick Kirshner. Welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Really glad that we could connect. Your documentary, How Healthcare Became Sick Care, was a huge inspiration for me. We watched it at our school at National University of Health Sciences as like a little group, class meeting, and really kind of blew my mind and, inspired me to write a book on the topic, as I've told you about. And so you've just, inspired me on many levels and just really grateful for all the work you've done. So I thought I'd have you on here and talk about, the great accomplishments you've done and kind of the how you see things right now and going forward. So to start off, what led you to study naturopathic medicine? What got you into all of this?
Oh, wow. Well, that's quite a story. So when I was, I think 15 or 16 years old, growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, somebody took me downtown to what at that time was, they called it a health food store, and it was a hole in the wall that basically sold grains and a few vegetables. I mean, it was like, compared to what you have today, was just such a simple little thing. And it was run by this older gentleman. And there was some about him that really resonated with me. He just seemed to be very wise, very knowledgeable, and extremely vibrant. And I remember that the people in his age group when I was that young didn't seem vibrant at all. They seemed kind of like various shades of gray. And this guy was really vital, alive. He was mentally awake, and he made an impression on me. All right, so that was in high school. When I was in my late teens, I was living, I had pursued a rock and roll career in Hollywood, and I wound up fleeing from Hollywood after my father refused to co-sign a contract. I did get a recording contract. My father refused to co-sign it, and they couldn't hold me to it because I was underage. I was only 18. They needed me to be 21 or a co-signer. So my dad came out to Hollywood. He met the people at the company and pulled me out in the hallway, says, "I'm not signing anything. And if you're smart, you'll get out of here. These people are going to chew you up and spit you out. They don't care about you at all." And he turned around and walked out of the building. 3 weeks later, I left Hollywood.
Wow.
And I wound up living in Northern California in a community that was part of a community of eight communities. Let's just say it straight up. I was pretty much a hippie. And we had a big feast, and at that feast, all the communities brought food. We had this long table made out of a tree in the middle of the main building, and it was covered with food. All right, so I left out an important detail. So when I left Hollywood, I wound up camping out on the Mendocino River, Northern California, and reading some pretty high-end books and very complicated books because I had nothing else to do living on the river. And one day I was taking a walk through the redwoods, and two women walked up to me, and one of them said to the other, "He seems like a good person." And the other one said, "How would you like a car?" And I'm like, "That sounds good." She said, "Just make sure you bring it back to me in October." Huh. And this was like in June. So she gave me keys to a Volkswagen. And I had no money. I had no way to pay for gas. So I came up with an idea. I'll pick up hitchhikers. And I'll tell them, I'll take you wherever you want to go, as long as you cover gas. And if something goes wrong, you fix the car. So I picked up a hitchhiker right away who said, "I want to go to Boulder, Colorado." I'm like, "Okay, sounds good." We get to Boulder. He wanted to go to what he called a spiritual festival that was taking place in some big athletic stadium in Boulder. And there were tents all around ringing this common area, and people milling about. And it seemed like every guru and health whatever had their own booth. I remember Mo Siegel, the guy who founded Celestial Seasonings, the tea company. He was preaching the Urantia book on a platform. And wow. So it was a pretty trippy area. And honestly, I wasn't that much interested in it, in any of that at the time. But there was a guy under a tree holding a sign written on cardboard that said, "Ask me about vegetarianism." So I sat under the tree and I said, "All right, what about vegetarianism?" And he did this whole download with me for like 4 hours.
Wow.
And I just sat there and listened because it let me people watch. And all right, so now we fast forward. I'm in this community. We've got all this banquet food laid out on a table. I ate like crazy. The party went on all night long. I ate until I was sick, and then I came back in and ate some more, and then got sick and ate some more. Uh-huh. And the next morning when I woke up, the pain in my body was so intense, I couldn't move. So I just lay there in bed, and suddenly that guy under the tree, everything he told me about health and how you are what you eat and all this, it just came back to me. And I just lay there unable to move, remembering everything this guy said to me. And that's really when my health journey started. I'd had that one experience in high school. Now I had this experience. And as I like to say, two experiences is enough to make a generalization. I decided to learn everything that I could. So I found herbals and read herbals. I learned about homeopathy. I was just fascinated with the whole idea that there was such a thing as natural medicine to treat what ails us as human beings. So life in the community was pretty boring. And at one point, my father offered me a trip overseas to Israel to get me out of the commune. And he said, you know, you got to put it together yourself. So I did. And when I got there, there was no work to be had because there'd been a war and everybody was depressed and it was pouring down rain. And I wound up in a vegetarian village in the mountains as an apprentice to a naturopath who was 83 years old, a woman named Roma Tsur. Wow. And she had people lining up out her door every day for her treatments and medicines. And I just got to watch all of that. And I was so impressed by it. And the things people said about the difference that she'd made in their life. And I thought at the time, boy, I wish you could still learn this kind of stuff. You know, I'm going to try to learn what I can here, but I wish you could go to school for this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I came back to the United States. I ran into, for my brother's wedding, I ran into the little sister of a guy I played rock and roll with in high school. She had papers under her arm. I said, "What's that?" She goes, "Oh, I'm applying to a naturopathic school in Oregon." Wow. I was like, "You can learn that?" And she's like, "Yeah." And that was it, man. I just had that classic light bulb moment where I was like, that's what I'm supposed to be. And so I did my pre-med and went to National. I graduated in 1981. Remember, you know, going through naturopathic school was quite a learning experience, and not in the way that most people would expect, because my extracurricular activity was what really held the most of my attention. Mm-hmm. Jim Sensenig asked me to go on a TV show to represent the school. In my third year, he asked me to go on this TV show, and I don't remember what I said on that show, but whatever it was, it impressed the guy in the audience who was the head of the OBGYN department at St. Vincent's Hospital at the time. And he began calling the clinic laboratory every single day to get a conversation with me. And I kept deflecting. And finally, one day, Ed Hoffman Smith, who ran the lab, said, "You have to take this call. This is annoying. We can't focus if this guy keeps calling." So I remember standing in the hallway, it was corded phones in those days, and talking to this guy. And he goes, "I want to make you a job offer." I said, "I'm not looking for work." He said, "Well, you haven't heard the offer." I said, "That's because I'm not interested." And he just pressed on and pressed on and finally said, "Look, how about if I buy you lunch?" Well, I was a student, and those are magic words. I was like, "All right, can I bring friends? Because you got to look out, right?"
Right.
So I brought three friends with me, and he paid for the meal. It was at a natural foods restaurant in downtown Portland. And he said, "There's two things." Two of the guys left after eating. My best friend at the time, Rick Brinkman, stayed there with me. And this guy says, "There's two things you're not learning in school that you need to learn to be a great doctor. And you want to be a great doctor, right?" I was like, "Yeah." He said, "You need to learn how to listen and you need to learn how to talk." And my response was, "Why?" And he said, "Because most patients would actually get better if their doctor would just listen to them. And most doctors make their patients sick by the way they talk to them." And I had a blinding flash of the obvious. I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is probably the most important thing you need to know to be a great doctor." He said, "If you won't come to work for me as my physician's assistant, where I'd give you more power than you'll ever have as a naturopath," he said, "if you won't do that, then at least let me be your mentor." And he gave us books to read. He sent us to training programs. Rick and I thought what we were learning was so profound that we put a workshop together. Rick was a senior. I was a third year student. The workshop was called The Magical Nature of Communication. And so many students turned up for it, which surprised us. And we were a little nervous when we started. And after about 5 minutes, the nerves went away. And it turned out to be one of the most fun things I'd ever done in my life.
Wow.
And that turned into a speaking and training career, book writing. All of that stuff came out of doing that little workshop at National. And, you know, I've been growing my internal database ever since. I've discovered a lot of things that nobody ever could teach me in school. I've discovered through my own experience. I've known a lot of amazing healers and amazing people in our profession and outside of our profession. Mm-hmm. And I am more aligned at this point in my life. I'm 72 years old. I'm more aligned at this point in my life with the idea that there is a complete alternative paradigm for healing and healthcare to the one that most people know of. And it's the better paradigm. And I am you could say I'm a true believer. I've witnessed such amazing healings in people, really recovering their health from seemingly impossible circumstances. So, you know, my heart aches for humanity because it doesn't seem to know that it has a choice. And I've done everything in my power to let people know that they have a choice.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, you have. And thank you for everything you have done. And wow, what a amazing journey you just shared there. That was really, really awesome. And probably just scratching the surface, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. I left out almost everything.
So, you know, it's a really interesting time right now. I think we're living in, I think the most interesting time of all of these paradigms coming to fruition all at the same time, you know, with the natural health medicine movement, holistic, vitalistic medicine, the paradigm of healing that you were just talking about. Also at the same time with cannabis and psychedelic legalization and getting people to think at a different, you know, level of consciousness about these things. Also with the cryptocurrency blockchain things that are going on. You know, I think that it's a really, really interesting time where I'm pretty optimistic that, you know, it's time for that paradigm shift. You know, only in this last 100 years, you know, thanks for your documentary, learning so much about how the Rockefellers came in and changed this whole medical education system and everything that came from that. You know, it's like, what about us being that other side to that and coming in with the money from people like, you know, whoever, Elon Musk or whoever, other people that haven't even been discovered yet, and doing the same thing the Rockefellers did, you know, but with changing the paradigm. Like, what do you say to that? What do you think it's going to take to really shift?
Well, I am a student of history. And one of the things we know from history is things tend to get really bad before they get better. I expect this thing to get worse before we come out of it. I do expect us to somehow come out of it. They've taken a wrecking ball, the people behind this whole thing, have taken a wrecking ball to all of the systems that were already corrupted and dysfunctional.
Yep.
The medical system is just being destroyed right now. The dominant system pushing this jab and these vaccine passports, they are wrecking healthcare. I can't give you the number off the top of my head, but a dramatic number of people are fleeing the healthcare system now, doctors and nurses, because either they're not willing to wear masks all around the clock, or they aren't willing to take the jab because they've seen the damage caused by it. Whatever the reason, doctors and nurses are leaving the system in droves. Meanwhile, this virus narrative was, and I should say this, I've been in the medical freedom fight for a number of years. We were trying to protect children in Oregon some years ago when they wanted to throw 37,000 healthy children out of school for missing a single dose of 72 scheduled vaccines. We protested, we showed up, we cared about it. And I remember talking to Jim Sensenig about this back when I first got involved with NMI. And I might have even said this to the entire board at the time, that this attempt to take away people's right to decide what gets injected into their kids was the point of a spear aimed at the natural health movement, that they were going to try to make it illegal to be healthy in a natural way, mm-hmm. that they wanted control of human physiology. So, boy, did that turn out to be right on the target. They have succeeded to a dramatic degree. I'm sure you know, Adrian, that they are now mandating this experimental gene therapy to students of naturopathic medical schools.
Yep.
They're requiring it of doctors in several states. You want to keep your doors open, you must submit to this gene therapy. And we have no long-term studies. We have no idea what damage they may have caused. We do know that the industry that makes these products is a known felonious industry that's paid billions and billions of dollars in fines for fraud. And, you know, so that anybody would accept the claims of that industry or the public health people that front for it blows my mind. But this is the state of the world. So yep. I think this is going to get worse before it gets better. I think we're already starting to see antibody dependent enhancement in people that got the jab. As the winter comes on, we'll see how serious this is. A lot of people that I find very credible think there's going to be a dramatic sick off, maybe even a die off of people that got this thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it breaks my heart because my colleagues, people that were in my friend group when I got out of school, have all rolled up their sleeves for this and have been militant against people like me who have spoken out based on the knowledge base that I thought we all shared.
Right.
So, you know, it's a pretty whacked out, crazy time. And it's entirely possible that our professional institutions are going to implode. Very possible that we're going to lose our schools, state licensing, all of that as part of how this thing continues to deteriorate. But as Benedict Lust and John Bastiere would say, the medicine will survive and it'll come back stronger than ever, probably be needed more than ever in the world coming into view. So as a student of history, I expect things to get much worse before they get better, but I do expect that we will come out the other side of this. And I've heard people cast it as the difference between the Great Reset, which is the economic desires of industry, and the Great Awakening, which is where the 99% of humanity recreates itself in a new and better way, takes the lessons of history and applies them. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Buckminster Fuller, and Bucky back in the 30s and 40s talked about the end of the womb of acceptable ignorance. He said, just like in the life of a child, there comes a time when the child has to learn to stand on their own two feet and face their future. Humanity will have to face its future. There will come a time. And he said that time would be brought about by sort of the collision of two forces that have been with us since the beginning of time. On the one hand, human innovation, creativity, and on the other hand, human stupidity and selfishness, and that they would clash through the medium of technology in our, probably in, he said, the late 20th, early 21st century, and that's where we are. I believe we are witnessing that clash of human creativity and innovation and human stupidity and selfishness. And that moment he called the end of the womb of acceptable ignorance, where humanity, it's a pass-fail test. We either stand and face our future and realize we're creating the future we're going to live in tomorrow today and take steps today to create it tomorrow we want to live in, or we fail. And one of the things we know looking out at the universe is not everything lives forever. Planets collide, stars explode. So maybe humanity will be a failed experiment, or maybe we will come out of this and have a great awakening, but it's going to be one or the other. So I'm working for the better world, not the bitter world.
Beautiful. Yeah. Wow. Very, very well said. Did you say you had a background in public speaking or something? Yeah.
I had a really great career with public speaking, actually. So,
You know, I just wanted to mention in there, you talked about, you know, it's a spearhead against the natural medicine community. No wonder that hashtag natural immunity is censored and blocked on all social media. It's like, why would that be the case?
Yeah. If you want to make something illegal, you got to disappear it. You got to censor it. You got to suppress it. You got to make people turn against it. And that's the interesting thing about what they've done with this virus narrative, is that they have somehow convinced people to disbelieve in their own empowerment and their own ability to address living in this world. And the shocking part is that it's happened to so many of our colleagues. I got to say, you know, anybody that spends any time in our profession talking with me gets to hear about how broken my heart is over the fact that so many of our colleagues have not only submitted to this thing, but have turned against people who speak out against it. Now, I think we're kind of coming through that because I think many of our colleagues are sort of waking up and going, wait a minute, what did I just agree to?
Yep.
Of how many boosters? Wait, what? What? So, you know, maybe we'll come to a better, kind of more harmonious something inside of our own community at some point here before the world does. But I'm not gambling on that. I'm just going to keep doing the work that I do. And this is where I think the Naturopathic Medicine Institute, if I may put in a plug for the Institute, I think the Institute is could very well be the last best hope for the naturopathic profession to thrive as a competing paradigm to the dominant system. Because NMI really has embraced the roots of our medicine and teaches the roots of our medicine and is actually very diligent in strong focus around our medicine. When I was, I spent a year as president in 2020, I thought, oh my God, what a horrible year to be president of anything. But I'm glad it was 2020 because 2021 is a much worse year. Right. At any rate, NMI's mission, as I used to describe it, was to preserve, protect, present, and promote the vitalistic core of our medicine. Mm-hmm. And NMI does that really well. And I, every chance I get, call on our doctors to join in that mission and support NMI. Whenever somebody says to me, I'm not getting anything out of NMI, I'm like, well, you're not supposed to get anything, even though there's a lot of offerings. You're supposed to give something to support this. This is our future here. And, you know, it's that what JFK said when I was a kid, he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I'm like, ask not what NMI can do for you, ask what you can do for NMI. Now, that said, NMI has some terrific offerings. It's got this VNMI credential that requires going through a real naturopathic program, learning how to be a naturopathic doctor, to think like one, treat like one, practice like one. And it's relevant to people in licensed and unlicensed states. So they have a lot to offer. But to me, that's the least important aspect of the Institute. We should be supporting the Institute and helping the Institute to grow and calling on our peers to join in to the work of the Institute for the benefit of humanity and for the sake of our profession.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I'm a huge, huge fan and advocate for NMI. And thanks to Dr. Louise Edwards that we had at our school. And she was, you know, a big advocate for vitalism. And we kept it very strong and alive in Illinois because we were forced to, because we were pre-licensed state, you know, so we really learned about vitalism and nature cure. And I'm all in. And the vital conversations are such a great learning tool. I've been going back from the very beginning, listening to them all, and just can't say enough great things about it. So I agree with everything you said. So going back to public speaking, what are three key traits that you think make for a strong, good public speaker?
Well, that's a fun question. Well, first and foremost, you need something to say. You got to have something to say. You got to have some kind of a message that's relevant to people's lives. And you got to believe in that message. You got to believe the message is so important that you need to share it. So first and foremost, and there's a lot of people that do professional speaking who don't have much of a message, and they put a lot of time into marketing. And then you have the organic version of professional speaking, which is you have something to say and word spreads. That's how I built my career. Word spreads and you get to say it to bigger and bigger crowds and in more and more places. So first and foremost, you have to have something to say. So anybody that I've mentored in this realm, first thing I tell them is, what is it you want to talk about? What is it that is in you, unique to you, that you want to share? And so that's the first thing. Second thing I think of is you have to develop your ability to influence and persuade. You know, there's somebody once said to me at the beginning of my speaking career, they said, do you want to impress or do you want to influence? If you want to impress, you know, you can have a big song and dance, fancy whatever, you can have, you know, big show, have guitar players on the side of the stage, you know, whatever. that's that there are people that have built careers just basically telling the story of their humble origins and look at me, I'm a success. There are people who have built careers, made a lot of money. In fact, I remember one time, probably about 15 years into my speaking career, where I was doing a breakout session and some big motivational speaker was doing the main session. And when people came into my group right after his speech, I was like, well, how was it? And I go, oh, it was really good. I said, great. Benchmark me against him. I want you to evaluate me based on what you think I share with you is relative to what he had to share with you. And I knocked it out of the park. So that's because I had really had something to share with people that was empowering to them instead of inflating about myself. So I think, you know, having the ability to influence, having the ability to persuade is really important in communication generally and really important in professional speaking. And the good news is that those tools are not hard to learn. You just have to want to learn them. So that's the second thing. And then I guess maybe the third thing is, I think you have to be, I'm not sure if the word is humility or open-minded, but I think you have to be willing to be growing in life to be effective in helping others to grow. If you're a done deal, if you've already decided it and figured it all out, and this is my story and I'm sticking to it, in my opinion, that makes you a poor speaker in the long term. Because you're just going to become a machine, just get out there and do the same thing over and over again. But if you're a growing person, if you're, you know, what's the saying? There's an agricultural saying, if you're green, you're growing. If you're ripe, you're rotten. If you're blue, you're through, right? So the idea is to be green and growing instead of ripe and rotten. So if you're green and growing, if you're acquiring new information, if you're open to learning from your audience, you know, their questions can guide you. I used to have a little game that I played where I'd notice the questions and then I'd go back to my hotel room or get on the airplane. And I would say, how can I add in the information that I learned was important to that person? How can I add this into my program? And my goal was to get to a point where nobody had questions. They'd be like, wow, he just answered all of that stuff. And that's how I built my best material, was by incorporating the learning experience of teaching. So that's, I'd say, the third thing is, it's something, I don't know if that's humility or just open-mindedness, but the willingness to keep learning in the process of presenting.
Love that. That's very helpful. Awesome.
Wow, did it.
Did you engage in any sort of like dialectical training or mental exercises, anything like that, before writing your books?
Well, I'll tell you the story of how we got our first book deal. It's very unusual. I think most people would love to have the experience I'm about to describe, who want to write a book. It's, I think in this day and age, it's next to impossible to have this kind of experience, but, so Rick and I were doing the magic workshop, and one of our students had lunch with the vice president of a big training company out of Colorado, the biggest training company in the world at the time, CareerTrack. And CareerTrack's business model was to send out thousands of brochures advertising their programs, and that would get them a few hundred people in an audience in cities all across America and at some point around the world. This student of ours had lunch with the vice president of that company and told him about Rick and Rick. And he was like, well, that sounds good. Tell him to send us their stuff. So he calls us up. He says, man, this is the best connection anybody's ever going to give you. But I just had lunch with this guy. And he said, send your stuff. And I was like, what stuff do we send? I don't even know what that means. And he says, I don't know. But he said, send them your stuff. Rick and I had been teaching at that point for, this was 1986. So we've been teaching together for 6 years at that point. And we had developed a lot of routines and a lot of fun material, and people really enjoyed it. And we reached out to a community in Portland. What was it called? This Science of Life Church or something like that, whatever it was. They loved us, and we called them up and said, hey, could you advertise that we need people to come to an event, and we're just going to do our favorite material. We're not going to try to teach anything. We're just going to do our favorite stories and jokes and routines and record it and send it to this company. And, well, we got a couple hundred people at that showed up at that event just for that purpose. So we recorded it. We put that in a box. We took all the letters people had sent us, telling us how good our stuff was. We put that together. We just made stuff, something up, put it in a box, gift wrapped it, and mailed it off, and then kind of forgot about it. Some months later, I had gone broke. I actually twice went broke as a naturopath. There was no insurance equality for us, and my town went into a recession. So twice I just lost all my income. Mm-hmm. And I was a single dad through all of that. So that was quite the adventure for me and my daughter. But anyway, I had just come out of the woods. I'd spent 3 weeks in the woods kind of fasting and really wrestling with my soul, you know, and I come back and I'm visiting friends, and I sent a phone number to Rick Brinkman, and he calls me and he leaves me a message on their message machine. And he's like, the best thing, you won't believe. And he starts naming all the benefits of working for this company. And it was like an answer from heaven for me. You know, you're going to have income. You're going to have work. They love you. They can't wait to meet you. They flew us out to the company. They picked us up in a limousine. They took us out to a fancy restaurant. And then they told us they were going to split us up. Mm. And I was like, why would you split us up? You just said you love what we do. We're like, you know, Lewis and the Martin and Lewis, we're a team. Uh-huh. And he says, yeah, I don't see it. And I'm like, well, we'll show it to you. So, and I didn't even know what that meant. I just was that kind of guy. So, anyway, they told us, we're having a big conference in January of 1987, and we're asking all of our training staff, and there's 55 of you, to bring 6 minutes of your best material and suits. And we're going to film you for a promotional video. So Rick and I talked it out. We thought, well, where's the opportunity in this? And we thought, let's go last. Nobody's going to want to go last. 55 speakers, that's going to be the deadest room in the world. You're going to hear the same stories over and over again. It's just going to be horrible. Mm-hmm. So let's go last. Because, you know, there's a thing that people remember the first thing and the last thing. All the stuff in the middle gets blurred out. Mm-hmm. So by going last, we might have a shot at really impressing them. Mm-hmm. We brought with us, we did bring suits. And the funny thing was, Rick and I both went into our, with separate rooms, went into our rooms, put our suits on and met in the hallway. And we were wearing the same suit, bought in two different cities without any consulting with each other. And it was a textured suit. I mean, it was like, how that even happened. But it was, we had a lot of synchronicity like that. Anyway, So we went and sat in the room. Sure enough, the room was deader than a doornail as they got close to the end. We left the room, two speakers before our turn, went back upstairs to our rooms and put on costumes. And they were military outfits and Castro hats and fake beards and mirrored sunglasses glued to comedy noses. And we came downstairs with a boombox with Santana's Oyo Como Va playing on it and marched into the room and went up on stage and did 2 6-minute comedy routines back to back. Making fun of the company's marketing.
Wow.
That's what we did.
Wow.
And the room went nuts. The vice president of the company was weeping from laughing so hard in the front row. And we got everybody singing. Well, I think we were singing on top of Santana's Oyo Como Va. We were singing, difficult people can be so difficult. We got everybody singing it along with it.
Wow.
And we get out in the hallway, and the president of the company was this young, almost cross-eyed, super intense guy because he was so focused. He's pacing back and forth, and he looks really mad. And I don't know what Rick thought, but I thought, well, I guess we've been fired before we've been hired kind of thing. But I said to him, are we fired? And he goes, no. I said, what's going on? He says, they didn't mic you properly, and we didn't get any of that.
Oh.
So he was mad that all of that got away. And then he just spun around on his heel and he says, I want a proposal on my desk by Valentine's Day for an audio program on dealing with difficult people. Can you do it? And we're like, sure. No idea what that meant. So anyway, we made an audio program for the company and we put in all this playful stuff. And at the time, most recordings, training recordings, were just dull. This was before John Cleese got into the business. It was just dull. And we did comedy. We had like a Leave It to Beaver sketch. We had Darth Vader strangling a manager. We put all this, we had the Beatles, who did a whole routine in Beatle lyrics. We just put all this kind of wild stuff into our audio program. And that program is still on sale today. This was like 1988 when that came out, I think, 87 or 88. It's still on sale today. I still get royalties from that audio program.
Wow.
Led to them asking us to do a video program, which we did, and put in all this playful stuff. And that led to being asked to write a book by the biggest publisher in the world on that subject. So we're just making it up. So we wrote a first draft. It was really fun. We had a lot of fun putting it together. We submitted it and didn't hear anything back for 14 months. By the time they sent back our manuscript, we didn't remember writing it. 14 months is a long time. Uh-huh. And he had taken it, the senior editor at Simon & Schuster had taken out all the best stuff in the book, everything that made it fun for us to write. So we said, we want to take our book back. Here's your advance money. We don't want to do this with you. And we shopped it around, and McGraw-Hill said, we'll do it. We'll do it the way you want to do it. We'll get it done in a year. That book is now an international bestseller. It's in 27 languages. It sold millions of copies. It's now a special edition on iTunes with audio and video in it. Wow. It's a spoken word version from Macmillan. I mean, it just turned into that. We became an industry, the Difficult People industry. And that opened a ton of doors for us and for me. Rick and I kind of went our separate ways at one point. I reinvented my career. Because there were things I wanted to talk about that were different than the problem with problem people. Mm-hmm. And I had an amazing career as a result. So,
wow. I think a lot of people would love to have that story. That's amazing.
I mean, being asked to write a book by a major publisher, it's like, are you kidding? That's so incredible. Yeah. And we got to have that experience. So
I love it. And I love your Superman cup you're drinking out of there too.
Oh, thanks for noticing.
Yeah.
Well, they're ruining Superman right now, but I still love the old Superman stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So staying on the topic of your books, if you're looking back on all of your writings and due to the kind of the change and growth in your life, if you could say something that you've said in your writings in terms of advice that you've given to others, like some stuff that really stands out, what would that be?
Well, you know, so let's talk about the Dealing with People book for a minute. So the subtitle of that book was How to Bring Out the Best in People at Their Worst. And the basic idea of that book is that if you can get to common ground with anybody, you can resolve differences. But if you start from your differences, you can't resolve anything. Mm-hmm. So the book is all about how do you get to common ground when people kind of lost control of themselves and they become pushy or negative or disruptive or explosive or wishy-washy and vague. How do you get to common ground with them? So we provided a lot of tools for that. But the basic idea is if you can get to common ground with people, you can solve almost any problem. Mm-hmm. So that's something. I would say that one of the main ideas that has carried through all of my work is what I call the nature of sanity. And it works like this. Whatever you assume to be true, you act like it's true because you assume it's true. So you act like it's true. And the way you act influences people, places, and things in such a way that you find proof so that you can be right about whatever you assume to be true. So that's the nature of sanity. It's self-fulfilling prophecy. For as you believe, so shall it be. You assume it's true, act like it's true, look for proof so that you can be right. And why do you want to be right? Because then you think you're sane, because you think you know who you are, where you are, and what's going on. That's why people want to be right. If I'm not right, who am I? You know, that kind of thing. So that's the nature of sanity. And this comes back to the vitalism paradigm. Because the vitalism paradigm is based on a set of assumptions, just like the conventional system is based on a set of assumptions. And everybody gets to be right. So the challenge to all of us as human beings is to do something more better with our life than being right about how it is, who's wrong, who's right. The better opportunity, I think, is to be like, well, I don't want to assume that I know something if it's not true. So I'd rather know what's true than be right about things I assume. That gives me an open mind. That gives me curiosity and fascination to explore things that I'm presented with. So when this virus thing came along, I felt like a lot of people trust me. A lot of people count on me to speak clearly and plainly. I have an obligation to do my due diligence and find out what's going on here. So I gave myself 2 months to read and watch and listen to everything I could to test my assumptions, which, by the way, is the scientific method, where you test your assumptions by trying to disprove them instead of looking for proof so that you can be right, which is what a lot of people seem to think science is all about. I have a hypothesis and I proved it. No. It's I have a hypothesis and I try to disprove it. And if it remains standing, I go, I must be onto something. That's science.
Yeah, like so, science is settled. Like what is that?
That's insanity. Science is never settled. If science were settled, it wouldn't be science. It would be belief,
right?
Or scientism, the belief that something is scientific because somebody told you that it is. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to test our assumptions in life. It's one thing to believe something. It's something else to demonstrate it through testing it. So I think that, you know, if I'm giving somebody advice, it's you should test your assumptions so you don't get trapped in self-fulfilling prophecy. Whatever you assume to be true, put it to the test. Try to disprove it. See if it remains standing. So I did that with the virus narrative. I went, all right, I'm going to assume that these people who are telling us this thing is happening are telling us the truth. So now I'm going to put it to the test. Is it true? And I looked for competing information. I looked for other studies. I looked for, you know, somebody said masks keep us safe. I'm like, is that true? Let's test that. And the more I looked, the more I found. It's like, wow, we have 20 years of masking science and say that's not true. Mm-hmm. 20 years they've tested that assumption, and all of a sudden it's we're putting that away. This is what you must believe. So I did that every step of the way through this thing, including with the jabs. I went, okay, they're saying this is effective. Is it? And when I tested it, I found out that they were talking about relative risk reduction instead of absolute risk reduction, which was negligible.
Yep.
So I just did this every step of the way so that I could maintain my credibility with people who trusted me, and also for my own satisfaction. I want to know what's real and what's true. And the result of that is that I wound up on the outside with a lot of old friends, a lot of colleagues, a lot of people that bought the belief system that was sold to them through propaganda, through relentless propaganda. They bought it. I tested it. And I drew a very different set of conclusions. And I got to tell you, you know, it's not fun to be on the outside. When everybody's going that way, it's not fun. But I also happen to know that when the crowd's all heading in a certain direction, if the crowd is wrong, they got a problem. Mm-hmm. And I know this because when I was growing up, my father had a very close friend, very dear friend, kind of like Rick and I were for 26 years, just really close. They learned how to fly planes together. They played golf together, started a business together. They just loved each other like brothers of different mothers. And his friend Jim was at the Beverly Hills nightclub in 1979 in Northern Kentucky. And there were a few hundred people in the banquet room, and a fire broke out and the room began filling with smoke, and the crowd rushed two doors, and both those doors were locked, and hundreds of people died, including Jim that night and his family. And meanwhile, there were three other doors that were not locked. Wow. So that made such an impression on me that just because the crowds all go in a certain way, I don't necessarily want to follow that crowd. I want to think for myself. And so I have spent my adult life thinking for myself, because that very painful experience for my father, I mean, you know, it was devastating for him. And when I learned what happened there, I was just like, man, following the crowd is not the smart choice. just not the smart choice.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. What a story. Thank you for sharing. So speaking on that, a specific question I have for you, how sustainable do you think the forced jabs for healthcare employees will be, especially with the Federation of State Medical Boards, the FSMB, threatening the licensure of those spreading jab misinformation?
Well, this is the wrecking ball, because decent people who can think for themselves are going to opt out of that. They'll give up their license if they have to. They're not going to submit to a lie. Just because everybody's saying something is true doesn't make it true. They're not going to submit to a lie. The good people, people of conscience and character, will extricate themselves somehow from being in front of that freight train. But that censorship and suppression is not sustainable, but in the short term, it's effective. It silences dissent. It shuts down critical thinking. People who have families to support, who have bills to pay, they are going to be extremely tempted to go along with the narrative and to disbelieve the evidence before their own eyes in order to maintain their income and maintain supporting their family. So I don't judge them harshly if they make that choice. I have empathy for them. But I don't believe this in the long run. This is not sustainable. It's just like, you know, what the Nazis did. They kept it going quite a ways and did a hell of a lot of damage. But eventually it did come to a stop. So, you know, I think that's the lesson of history. All things play themselves out, but they come to a point. And that was what Martin Luther King said, that the arc of history bends towards justice. It doesn't mean it's quick, it's easy, or it feels good, but it does eventually get there. And that's why I'm somewhat optimistic that we're going to come out the other side of this thing and recreate these systems without the corruption in it. Now, that said, I also know that history is cyclic, just like everything else in nature. So I was at a medical freedom movement just a few days ago, and somebody talked to me afterwards, and she was like, well, do you think we're going to win? Do you think we're going to win this somehow? And I said, eventually, I think the truth will out, and there will be a reckoning and an accounting, and people will be held accountable for the misleading of the people around them based on a false belief. I do think that eventually we will get there. And I do think that we will be able to do something worthwhile as a result of all of this. This will lead to something worthwhile. I said, but I also believe that within two generations, corruption will fill up all these systems again, because the consistent problem in human history is humans. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it is. There's always wolves among the sheep, predators among the prey. That's built into nature's design. That never goes away. So no matter how coherent of a system you create, somebody's going to come along and screw it up at some point. So, and she goes, well, then why bother? I said, because it's not for you to question why, it's but for you to do or die. The fact of the matter is, you've been given a life, you've been given certain knowledge, you've been given certain connections, and for you to live a fulfilling life, for you to live a life worth living, you've got to have character. You've got to be true to yourself. You've got to stand for something instead of kneeling for anything. And that's why the arc of history bends towards justice, because the individual speaks up, stands up, cares enough to do the right thing. That's it. How it turns out 1,000 years from now, it's going to go up, it's going to go down, it's going to be terrible, it's going to be great. That's out of our control. That's something we have no say over at all. But what we do today matters in our own lives. I'm living a life of meaning and purpose, and as a result, I am vital and alive. So that's the best I have to offer on that.
Yes, yes, you are. And wow, what inspirational words there. Thank you. Those gave me goosebumps. You know, why Dr. Rick Kirschner, somebody as celebrated, you know, public speaker, worked with Fortune 1000 companies, why would somebody like you be deplatformed off of LinkedIn in July 2021? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, one of the interesting paradoxes of social media is that it started off as this beautiful way to connect with community. So I have all these chapters in my life that had different people in those chapters. And suddenly on Facebook, I was able to have all those people back in my life, reconnect with people I knew in high school, reconnect with people from my music career, reconnect with people from the community, on and on and on. So that's beautiful. You share pictures, you share things you're thinking about. It was open. Everybody could talk about whatever was on their mind. And I cared about medical freedom. So I had a lot to say, so much that my family is like, tone it down, man. You're gonna, I'm like, this is me. This is what I have to say. So, you know, I had a great LinkedIn account. I had thousands and thousands of contacts and connections all over the world. I had testimonials from people about the quality of my work. You know, it was a really nice thing that somebody could kind of look at that as an online brochure and go, wow, that guy's, he's done some stuff. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn turned me off because I was sharing scientific data that countered the counterfactual narrative that they prefer. Facebook does the same thing. Twitter does the same thing. They turn people off. They put them in jail. They take away their voice because it goes against their preferred narrative. And the sad truth is most people don't know how bad it is until it happens to them. I did know because I watched all these really brilliant people disappearing from my social networks. And when I'd reach out to them privately, they took my platform away. They took my voice away. So I watched this happening to other people, and I knew it would happen to me sooner or later. And in fact, I had a huge Facebook account where I had thousands, thousands of people that were following stuff that I had to say. And I had a Twitter account with thousands and thousands of people, you know, and I was asked by my publishers to do that kind of thing, to build my social network platform for their, to help with sales. Mm-hmm. So I was diligent. I did build my social platform, but the censorship first hit Facebook and Twitter, which I now call Fakebook and Twister. And I took myself off both of those platforms in protest over the censorship, thinking that people that trust me and listen to me would notice that and go, we should notice that guy that we liked, he walked away. Maybe we should take a look at what's happened. But I don't think it had that effect at all. I think life just kind of went on. Mm-hmm. But LinkedIn was my business community. That wasn't my social, personal contacts so much as my business contacts. And that was my whole career. You know, 30 plus years of career was connected to that account. So I stayed on there for that reason. I had all these business contacts, people I'd gotten to know through my work that were, you know, really amazing people. I got to meet some amazing people. So I wanted to keep those connections alive. What's kind of fun about this is that when LinkedIn first started, I accidentally created two accounts and couldn't figure out which one to keep. So I tried to work both of them for a while. This is back in the early days of LinkedIn. So I got a few hundred people on this one, a couple thousand. And then I was like, I'll just go with the thousands and just let the other one fall into neglect. Didn't even look at it. So when they took down my account, I just opened up the other one and started right back in. And what I've learned about these platforms is, you know, they don't suppress everybody all the time. They are very particular who they suppress. They suppress people whose voice is spreading. So if 100 people look at something I post, it might get the attention of their bots and fact checkers. But if 1,000 people are hearing my voice, that represents a real problem. And that was what was happening. I was getting hundreds of connection requests every week on LinkedIn before they took down my account. So clearly things I was posting were spreading. Mm-hmm. And that's why I believe they took me down.
Wow. Yeah. Just like Dr. Mercola and all of these guys with a lot of followings, they just came after them hard. But, you know, Dr. Patch Adams came and spoke at my school for a graduation, you know, commencement speech. And it was so inspirational because he said he gets 10 death threats a year.
Yeah.
And why is that? Because he's trying to start a free hospital, God forbid, right?
Yeah.
And that was really inspirational to me. I said to everybody at school, and I mean it, like, I know I'm not doing what my purpose here is until I start getting death threats. And like, I have no fear about that. I really don't. That's what I'm here for.
you know, you're alive as long as you're alive, and everybody dies at the perfect time. And I just am not going to live my life fearing death. I'm going to live my life living life. I got death threats on Twitter. I got a lot of death threats. I had my license threatened on Facebook. I had threats. I had people in the AANP were actually screenshotting my posts and discussing them at board meetings. So, wow. Yeah, it was kind of like, wow, you really get to see people's character in a crisis. It's very revealing.
Yep.
So, wow. But yeah, I've always said, not always, but for a good part of my life, I've said they only kill you if you're really effective. So be
really effective and not too effective.
Yeah. Find the sweet spot. Yeah.
Got it. So I want to end with one of my favorite topics. And it kind of goes along with your background with being in rock and roll in Hollywood in the 60s, cannabis and psychedelics. So yeah. What can you talk about with that realm? I could talk about that for days and days. I'm very passionate about, you know, the medicinal uses of these plant substances that are here for many reasons. So not only the medicinal aspect, but also the recreational, you know, when we're responsible adults about it. Right. So what can you talk about with that topic?
Goodness. So, first of all, I think that the reason they tried to suppress cannabis with such intensity, was economic. I think threatened economic interests that people were going to use hemp. That's where I think this all really started.
Yep.
And the secondary part of it was that people seemed to be having a good time, that they didn't want having a good time. So mm-hmm. I think some of that was a part of that in the early days, you know, back in the 20s and 30s and 40s,
right.
When they really came after cannabis. And then I think in the 60s, when they went after psychedelics, it was because the musicians were setting a bad example for society and they were really trying to shut that down. You know, after the Beatles dropped acid, their music went to a whole different place and their genius really emerged. So they didn't like that. So I think that was why they tried to shut it down. I also think that keeping cannabis illegal serves a very different purpose, which is that the pharmaceutical industry wants people to believe that things in nature have no power. And anybody that has experimented with psychedelics and cannabis that come from nature can tell you, there's a lot of power in this stuff. It's mind-blowing, eye-opening, ear-opening, life-expanding. So
yep.
That's bad for the drug industry if you can use a product that takes you away from their product line. And I think that that's got a lot to do with why the laws haven't really changed about these things, is that if people realize just how powerful the things in nature are, they will join the paradigm of healing and expansion instead of the paradigm of sickness and contraction that is the business model of those industries.
Yes, very well said. I agree 100%. And that's why I mentioned in the beginning, you know, I think all of these things happening right now, cannabis being legalized in over 30 states now medically, you know, 13 or 14 recreationally, psychedelics coming to fruition. I mean, $17 million, you know, funded at Johns Hopkins Psychedelic Research Center and all this stuff happening, you know, phase 3 clinical trials with MDMA for PTSD, curing treatment resistant PTSD in 3 sessions. Of course, the pharmaceutical companies don't like that. You know,
bad for business.
Yeah.
And ultimately bad for business is how you know what's going to be shut down.
Right.
It's bad for those industries, these dominant players in the world scene that are backed by investor class money at a very high level, then you can tell, oh, they're going to turn that up. They're going to try to shut that down. They're going to try to make people get away from that, because that's bad for business. And that's been the problem of the naturopathic profession from its inception, is that happy, healthy, life-fulfilled people are bad for business of these destructive, contracted industries.
Yep. Yep. And that's why I think the solution to all of this is you layer on top the cryptocurrency blockchain, which the whole idea is decentralization. There is no one person or group of people at the top. It's all of us, you know, ruling it together, kind of back in the commune days. Like, that whole idea is coming back strong.
And oh, it's coming back. Turn on, tune in, drop out. It's starting to make sense all over again.
Yes, sir. Yep. Yep. So I'm excited. And I appreciate having you on the podcast. It's been really wonderful. And really, really looking forward to all the great things that, you know, get to create with, you know, similar background I have with business and trying to kind of figure out how to layer all that together. And I'm really have some big visions and would love to help to change this entire paradigm. So I think with our tribe here that we've assembled, we're definitely going to make that happen. So I look forward to it. And
I wish you great success in all your endeavors, all your enterprises. Bucky said that the universe thinks you're important because it only made one of you. And if you're still here, your mission ain't done. So, you know, if they cloned you, it wouldn't be you. There's only one you with your background, your experiences. You're unique, just like all the rest of us. And if everybody just lived their lives true to themselves, the whole world would work out.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Very well said. And, you know, living from our heart and not our ego, right? Living from love, coming from love.
Well, so you know, we all have our own way of saying things. And that's also part of the beauty of this thing, is there's a lot of ways of expressing the same thing, just as there are a lot of ways of interpreting the same thing. I had a little thing on a bulletin board downstairs that says live to serve. That's been sort of my mantra for my whole adult life. The whole idea that a life lived in service is a life worth living. And if you don't live a life in service, you probably don't deserve much of a life. I think it's interesting the word deserve contains the word serve. I have done my best in my brief sojourn on this planet to be of service, to be useful, and to do worthwhile things. And to the degree I've done that, I've experienced a great deal of fulfillment. I wish that for you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you again for all the work you have done and the millions you've impacted, and to look forward to our next conversations, hopefully in person there in Idaho when I come visit.
Yeah, of course. And for whoever listens to your podcast, if you believe in medical freedom, I did create a private group on Telegram. All you got to do is send me an email, rick@talknatural.com. And tell me your interest in medical freedom, and I'll send you an invite to my private group.
Awesome. Yes, it's a really, really awesome group. Highly recommend reaching out for that. And thank you again so much. And we'll be in touch.